We're studying the book of Leviticus. We've been going through the book sequentially, chapter by chapter. Sometimes it's of benefit to look at the book of Leviticus or issues in there in the context of the whole Bible, specifically the Old Covenant. You see, if we do that sometimes, step back and look at Leviticus in the context, we find principles or lessons that we don't get if we just do nothing but go through it sequentially. One of the issues we've been looking at that I want to look at in a bigger context is the issue of the priesthood. And that was a group of men who were intercessors between God and human beings. Priesthood is covered primarily in Exodus and Leviticus. Let me stress again, the priesthood was temporary. It lasted from 1450 BC, time of Mount Sinai, until 31 AD when Jesus died on the cross. There is no priesthood now that is of other people. Because in the New Covenant, based on people who were born again by that one-time act of trusting in Jesus as Savior, that moment we trusted in Him, He became our high priest. We don't need other people to be our priest. Now, some religions are fixated on the Old Covenant. For example, the Roman Catholic Church, they're still stuck totally in the Old Testament on the issue of priesthood. Now, most Protestants are also fixed at a level. Most Protestants are fixed at the level where Jesus is our high priest. Now, that is absolutely true. But where most people don't go is the next step, and that is for those of us who have been born again by trusting in Jesus, since we have become identified with Him, we are now our own high priest. 1 Peter 2:9, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood. And notice he combines priest and king, priest and government. That's what I'm going to look at today. So 1450 BC to 31 AD, we had a priesthood. 31 AD, Jesus became our high priest. We take it further. Since I am identified with Him by trusting in Him, I am now my priest, my own priest. We find that similar point of 1 Peter 2:9 in Exodus 19:6. God tells Moses, "You shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." See that again? Combination government and priests. The point is this. Beginning in 1450 BC, priests became the political leaders over the Jews, and not just religious, not just spiritual. And that's because Israel was a theocracy. A theocracy is a form of government in which a country is ruled by religious leaders. In antiquity, the most famous country that was a theocracy was Egypt, where Pharaoh was considered a god. Today, we have theocracies in many Muslim countries that are caliphates, where you have the quote, spiritual leaders, also governmental leaders. Israel, beginning in 1450, was a unique theocracy, a special kind of theocracy, because it was seen that the priests were not really ruling over Israel. The concept was God Himself was ruling over Israel. He was the king. He was the prime minister. There was never anything like that before, and there has never been anything like that since. A pure theocracy. Now, God wanted that to continue. He said, "Let me just keep being your king." There was always this undercurrent. We want a king. We want a king. God later very reluctantly allowed that. But I want us to understand that Israel's government was unique. That theocracy. And you see, there's a lot of confusion today about to what degree can we use Israel as a model for government. Or many times people will take quotes that God gave to Israel, "If my people who are called by my name will pray," and they apply it to America. So to what degree is that valid? I want to address that. Also, I'm going to address the specific issue of the United States. Many Christians believe that America is a Christian nation. Of course, the secular community doesn't believe that at all. By the way, we see some of that in England as well, although it's fading. So today I want to look at the biblical patterns of government, the degree to which the biblical picture of government is valid for the United States. I also think we can see, if we understand this concept, why it is that America has prospered, and also why many nations have prospered throughout human history. I'm going to go ahead and tell you the answer. It's not that they are necessarily Christian. A nation does not have to be, quote, Christian to be successful. To be successful, a nation has to follow the Noahic covenant, which was the last covenant given to all the human race. So about 1450 BC and extending through the time of the judges, Israel was a theocracy. God was their ruler. They kept clamoring for a king. Finally, God allowed a king. They got this guy Saul about 1050 BC. It was total, absolute disaster. Now let me stress, God reluctantly allowed a king. But the big picture is, God only reluctantly allowed for human government. God didn't even want human government. For obvious reasons. What kind of people are you going to put in charge? What kind of people are available? Are any good people available to put? No, there aren't any good people. So God's saying, so we're going to have a system of government where people rule themselves, but they're all sorry. That's his thinking. He probably thought it a little bit better than I just expressed. So now I want to show why it is that God reluctantly allowed human government. I want to trace the concept of government all the way back to the Garden of Eden. And how many times do we solve a problem by going back to the Garden of Eden? Well, in the Garden of Eden, there was certainly no government. I mean, there were just two people. Who's going to be the leader? Are they going to take turns? They were free to do whatever they wanted to do, except not eat that one fruit. And that setting in the Garden of Eden is the setting for the first covenant between God and human beings. Covenants or dispensations refer to the different ways God has dealt with people throughout the ages. The purpose of every covenant or dispensation was to lead people to the cross, but through history, there are just different ways to administer that gospel. So the first covenant was the Edenic covenant, and the provisions of the Edenic covenant are very, very simple. Do whatever you want, just don't eat that one fruit. But Adam ate the one fruit, he fell about 13,000 BC, and that ended the Edenic covenant. The Edenic covenant was over. Adam and Eve moved slightly outside the garden. They could still see it. They were in the vicinity. And Eve gave birth to twin boys, Cain, slightly the older, and Abel. When they were adults, they brought offerings. And by the way, they weren't even told to bring offerings. They just wanted to do it. Well, Abel's offering was accepted and Cain's was not. Abel did bring an animal, and Cain brought plants. That wasn't the problem. Remember, they weren't even required to bring offerings anyway. The reason that Abel's offering was accepted was that Abel saw through the offering that he was a sinner, and that only through the death of the Messiah could he be saved. Abel saw that animal he brought as a picture of the Messiah. Abel was saved. Cain's offering was not accepted. Again, not because it was plants. It was because it was his own self-effort. He had a green thumb. Cain loved to plant. He was great gardener, and he brought his own stuff, and I can have access to God because I'm such a good person. So Abel's was accepted, Cain's was not, and Cain gets jealous, and Cain starts seething. Now he starts plotting, and God comes to him. Genesis 4:7, if you do well, it doesn't mean if your behavior is right, it means if you get it that you're a sinner, you can only be saved by the death of the coming Messiah, that's doing well. Will not your countenance be lifted up? And if you do not do well, what do you mean to not do well? Continue on with thinking that your self-effort can get you to heaven. Sin is crouching at the door. This is a great personification of the sin nature within Cain. It's like two voices within him. One voice is the voice of the image and likeness of God saying, you need to go to the cross, Cain. The voice of his own flesh is, you don't need the cross, you're a good person. It's not fair. That's the voice of the conscience. So now we have the second covenant between God and the human race, and it's the covenant of conscience. So there's still no government. There's no government in the world. Everybody just follow their conscience. Let your conscience be your guide. Well, did it work? Well, no, because Cain killed Abel. Isn't it amazing? The first human being that was born was a murderer. Well, we have a quick indication that the covenant of conscience is not working. So what happened to Cain? Well, you think, well, God, I bet God whacked him. Well, no, he didn't. Genesis 4:12, when you cultivate the ground, it will no longer yield its strength to you. I mean, your green thumb is over. Well, isn't that being cruel? No, that's God extending mercy to Cain. See, Cain is counting on his ability to grow crops. That's what makes him a good person. That's how he identifies himself. That's his self-identity. God says, if I take that away from you, maybe you'll stop relying on yourself and turn to the cross. So he did it as an act of mercy. Now, the second thing he says sounds like a punishment. It's not. You will be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth. Now, the first is something that God did. He eliminated his ability to be a good farmer or gardener. But the second thing, it's just something that will happen. He didn't say, I'm driving you out, did he? He said, you will be a vagrant and a wanderer. That wasn't a punishment, that was a prediction. It amazes me, basically, Cain got away with it. He wasn't executed. And you know why? Because there was no human government to execute him. So God didn't really punish him. In fact, God protected him. Genesis 4:15, so the Lord said to him, therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold. Remember the word sevenfold, because one of his descendants is going to use that. And the Lord appointed a sign for Cain so that no one finding him would slay him. No one knows what that sign was, but it was obvious. Now, no government. Why did God protect him? Here's why. God did not want to allow a pattern of vigilante action on the earth. That's why he protected him. So Cain leaves. Genesis 4:16. Then Cain went out from the presence of the Lord. There we go. He didn't just leave the area. He went out from the presence of the Lord. See now, when God told Cain, you will be a wanderer on the earth. See, that was a prediction. That wasn't a punishment. That's what Cain did. Cain left on his own will. And settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. By this time, Adam and Eve had had many, many more children. So he went to people he didn't even know. So now Cain, off in the land of Nod, he starts having descendants, and there's a long line of people that came from Cain. And as bad as Cain was, as his line continued on, everything deteriorated even worse. Till we come to this big jerk named Lamech. Lamech was a big jerk. His name, Lamech, it means strong or big. Yeah, he was a big oaf. He was a big ape. And Lamech here gets him two wives. Verse 19, the name of the one was Adah, and the name of the other was Zillah. So we have Lamech, this big ape, and these two girls, Adah and Zillah, the technical term for them would be floozies. Now let me tell you about their names so we get a picture here. Adah literally means adornment. But in antiquity, the word actually referred to the reaction of people. She had so much jewelry on that she was thrilling. She was a thrilling woman. And then Zillah literally means like jingling bells. But these people, they wore way too much makeup. But you see, for a redneck, a chick like this, he'd call her drop-dead gorgeous. So here's what we've got, if you want to remember. Adah was a thriller. Zillah was a killer, and they married a gorilla. Look at this jerk. Lamech said to his wives, Adah and Zillah, listen to my voice, you wives of Lamech. See what I'm saying? Big oaf. Give heed to my speech, for I have killed a man for wounding me and a boy for striking me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, see that story was passed down. Then Lamech 77-fold. How did Lamech know about this sevenfold issue with Cain? Obviously, Cain had bragged about it, and that story had passed down. We do whatever we want. Now he's not only a murderer, now he's just flaunting it like Nanny Nanny Boo Boo. Well, obviously, the second covenant, the covenant of conscience, wasn't working. The people's consciences were hardened, and there was no government. to punish the evildoers. So the line of Cain continued on, continued to grow numerically. In fact, the line of Cain over in a few thousand years grew to somewhere between 5 to 15 billion people in a few thousand years. Meanwhile, closer to the Garden of Eden, Adam and Eve had another son named Seth, and he was saved. And he had descendants. Most of them were saved, but the problem with the line of Seth was that it was numerically very, very small. So by the year 10,000 BC, the line of Cain had produced 5 to 15 billion people, whereas the line of Seth had produced 8. There are only 8 people left of the line of Seth by the year 10,000 BC. Now let me back up, because during those 3,000 years, something happened to the line of Cain beyond normal human deterioration, and that is that demons somehow took human form and intermarried with human women and produced a race of mutants. They weren't even human beings. Half human, half demon. Not human. And they kept corrupting more and more. So God now says, well, look, here's what's going to happen if I don't intervene. Genesis 6:13, God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me." The wording is very intriguing. He doesn't say, "I'm about to kill all flesh." He said, "The end has come before me," meaning I'm about to see it. He said, "If I don't intervene, I'm actually seeing the end of the human race." So God sent the flood, not to destroy the human race, to preserve the human race. Everybody killed in the flood, they were mutants. Not one human being was lost in the flood. It was the mutants. Well, after the flood, again 10,000 BC, God put means in place to deal with the fact that the covenant of conscience wasn't working. So God put a system in place to punish people who did evil, to provide some kind of restraint. Because it had become obvious, when people get away with murder, there's no restraint anymore. And generations down, people are still bragging about what their ancestor did. So the system that God put in place after the flood was human government. And human government is part of the third covenant, which is the Noahic covenant. The Noahic covenant was addressed to the entire human race. You know how we know? Because after the flood, there were just 8 people. You ever thought about that? The entire human race after the flood was 8 people. Noah, his 3 sons, and their wives, and Noah's wife. That's the whole human race. Genesis 9:18, the sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, Japheth. And so now, when God gives the provisions of the Noahic covenant to this group, he's addressing the entire human race. The reason I'm stressing this is that the Noahic covenant is in effect today. It's not one of the old ones that went away, like the Mosaic covenant. It's in force right now. And today I'm going to show you there's something that we see frequently that confirms that the Noahic covenant is still in effect. So after the flood, it's really intriguing. Genesis 8:20, Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal, every clean bird, and offered burnt offerings on the altar. We don't have burnt offerings until the book of Leviticus. Meaning, he was already just doing that out of his own understanding. Remember, burnt offering means Jesus paid it all. So Noah comes out of the ark, first thing he does is say, "I'm only here because of the Messiah," we would say Jesus. Now he's about to announce to Noah the Noahic covenant. And let me just tell you, the Noahic covenant has 2 big parts. Now, as opposed to the new covenant, which we're under now, the new covenant, which is the covenant of grace, it's unilateral. It's all God's doing. His salvation, he elected us to be saved, he gave us the faith to be saved, and he regenerated us, and he saved us. It's all unilateral. The Noahic covenant was not unilateral. There was a part for God, and there was a part for man. So part one is items that God sovereignly did for this earth, for the benefit of humanity. And part two is the human perspective. Part two of the Noahic covenant is this: processes by which a nation can prosper in the fallen world. So part one is God says, "Here's what I'm doing for you. going forward throughout history. And two, if you nations want to prosper, here's what you do. So you see, the Noahic covenant is not for individual behavior. It's for nations to follow if they want to be successful. And let me stress, if a nation wants to be successful in the year 2017, they still need to follow the Noahic covenant because it's still in effect. Now, here's part one then, what God did unilaterally. And the first thing that God did unilaterally was to provide regularity and predictability of nature. Genesis 8:22. While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. There's the first provision of the Noahic covenant. Regularity and therefore predictability of nature. It's impossible to overstate the benefit of the predictability of nature. We could not live without the predictability of nature. See, before the flood, the earth was upright. The axis was straight up and down. At the flood, it tilted a little bit, and that provided seasons, except in Houston. Think about how important it is to have predictability of seasons. We could not even have agriculture without predictability. Now we know we can plant the fall crops, we can plant the spring crop, because we know what seasons are going to come. During the time of ancient Israel, the Nile would flood on schedule all the time, and they knew when to time the planting of their grain with those floods. What about predictability of things in the sky? You see, they didn't have GPS systems then. They didn't have satellites. You realize without the predictability of nature, the stars, the planets, they would not have known where they were. It's easy to take for granted now because we do have GPSs, but I was looking last night. There's actually some stars you can see in Houston. Look at the moon tonight. There's a big red star right beside the moon that I saw two nights ago. It's called Aldebaran. It's a monster. It's 44 times bigger than our sun. And it's a mid-sized star. I remember Jerry Gregory was a navigator. Before they had GPS, they didn't have satellites. And he counted on stars like Aldebaran for navigation. Well, Aldebaran better be there again tomorrow. And it better follow the course that we're used to seeing it follow. Anyway, the predictability of nature has been a tremendous blessing. And here's the second thing that God unilaterally did for the benefit of the human race. It involved animals. Genesis 9:2. The fear of you and the terror of you will be on every beast of the earth. He's making animals now afraid of men as a protection of man. You know, you want those lions and tigers to be a little bit afraid of us. Now, there was a third provision. In the third provision that God unilaterally made, the Noahic covenant, also it involved animals. 3, every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. When I lived in South Louisiana, I saw that they followed that to the letter. It doesn't matter. If it's alive, they were even iffy on moving. I give it to you as I gave the green plant. I believe what happened is this. Before the flood, when they had the canopy around the earth, the oxygen level would have been much, much higher. And so I think people from fruits and vegetables alone could have easily gotten everything they needed, including the protein from the plants. After the flood, it's still possible and it's still perfectly valid to be a vegetarian. It's just more difficult to get what you need if you're a vegetarian. That's the thing. So that's just a provision. There's one exception, one stipulation, is you can eat meat, but verse 4, you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is its blood. We've seen this in Leviticus. Leviticus 7:26, you're not to eat any blood, either of bird or animal, in any of your dwellings.
What about a rare steak?
Or yeah, or tell a Cajun about blood sausage, couillage. Remember, now we can eat whatever we want. But this was a provision. It was temporary. And the reason was this. Humans cannot eat blood because blood in the Old Testament was a picture of life. And so humans can't eat life. And the picture is only God can give life. And only God can take life. But there's one exception. When I say only God can take life, there are provisions under which human beings are to take life. And that brings us to part two of the Noahic Covenant. And that is, if a nation wants to prosper, what does a nation have to do in order to prosper? And here's number one. Genesis 9:6, whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. Now we're beginning part two of the Noahic Covenant. And this is, what does a group of people, what does a nation do to be successful, to prosper? And do you see, it's amazing to me, I would have come up with all kinds of things. God says the number one thing for a nation to do to prosper is to exercise capital punishment. Kill murderers. I think we Christians now have let the argument go the wrong direction. Christians have gotten caught up in the argument of, is it a deterrent or not? You see, that's not the issue. God didn't even deal with that. Deterrent was not mentioned. Why are we supposed to execute killers? To preserve the image and likeness of God. You see, when we execute somebody who's murdered somebody, we're saying that we value human life so highly that when you have the audacity to take life that only God can take, you have to give your life in return. People say, well, it devalues human life to have capital punishment. No, it values human life to have capital punishment. Now, the whole issue of deterrency, you see, is not a factor. But if you want to bring it up, let me bring this up. When a person is executed, what is the likelihood that he is deterred from any future crime?
Pretty good.
Yes. Judge Parker, Hanging Parker, Judge Isaac Parker from Arkansas, sent 160 people to the gallows. Judge Roy Bean, law west of the Pecos in West Texas, sent 88 people to the gallows. I did some extensive research. Took me all week. I uncovered some information that's mind-boggling. Of those 244 people who were sent to the gallows, not one of them ever committed another crime. Weeks. So, if they want to make deterrence an issue, there's the issue, but it's not the issue. Capital punishment is the only way to demonstrate the value of human life. And I tell you something else, the punishment has to be executed quickly. Ecclesiastes 8:11, because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the sons of men among them are given fully to do evil. Now we have the situation where somebody is convicted of murder. We know he did it. And he sits there in prison for literally decades. Well, when people say, well, there's no deterrent. Well, yeah. If someone sits in prison for decades after killing somebody, any possible deterrent is now gone. Also, I'll tell you what else that does. Somebody murders somebody and he's not executed for decades. That devalues the life that was stolen. Isn't that a dishonor to the person whose life was taken?
And it goes further. He gains more and more sympathy as time goes on.
Yeah, and that's another thing that gets me, is that we start feeling sympathy for the people in prison. Romans 13:4, Paul talking about government says, it is a minister of God to you for good, it being human government. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it, that's the government, does not bear the sword for nothing. For it, human government, is a minister of God, and look at these words, strong words, an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. We're talking about avenging. We're talking about wrath. We're not talking about put them in a nice place and hope they'll be better people. The purpose of capital punishment is strictly that, punishing them. And people who are in prison, they're supposed to be punished. The Bible makes no apologies for saying it's to punish them. So the first provision of human government Noahic covenant that nations are to follow is capital punishment. And the reason I keep saying nations is that it's clear that capital punishment is to be exercised in the context of human government. So here in Noahic covenant, we actually have the beginning of human government. That means that punishment is carried out through legal processes, not vigilante action. So the obvious question, since human government is not specifically mentioned here, how do we know that the provision for capital punishment is in the context of human government? Here's how we know. Because the sequence of chapters that follow are not in chronological order. See, Genesis chapter 9 is the Noahic covenant. Genesis chapter 10 is the nations, the sovereign nations with borders that are in place. And then chapter 11 is the Tower of Babel that created those nations. See how it's out of order? So God deliberately paired Genesis 9, the Noahic covenant, with Genesis 10, human government. So we'll get the picture that you don't just decide on yourself to go kill somebody who's killed somebody. You do it in the context of a human government. So the point now here, if a human government wants to be successful in this world, what does it have to do? The first thing that government has to do is exercise capital punishment. Kill murderers. And also, by extension, the sword extends for external protection. If you want more information about that, go to radicalgrace.com. The studies of 1 Peter, lesson number 11, which explains more of the role of government in defending externally. But I'm really talking about more internally, capital punishment to restrain evil in a fallen world. So, the Noahic covenant, think about this, the Noahic covenant is for the entire human race. Therefore, any nation, anywhere on earth, any time in history, who wants to prosper, what should it do first? Capital punishment. And there's a second thing that a nation should do to prosper, and that is simply acknowledge a higher power. Genesis 9:12, this is the sign of the covenant that I'm making between me and you and every living creature with you for all successive generations. There we stress, it's forever, for all people, all generations. And here is the sign. Here is your sign. I will set my bow in the cloud. There's the rainbow. And it shall be a sign of a covenant between me and the earth. When the bow is in the cloud, then I will look upon it to remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh on the earth. The sign is the rainbow. That meant that human beings have to look up to see the sign. And rainbows are something that are prevalent throughout the world. Anywhere in the world you are, there's rainbows. The reason I'm saying that, I used to like to visit South America. I love astronomy and look at the sky. South America, it always intrigued me. I saw constellations and stars that I'd always heard of, but I'd never seen them. And I was thinking about that, and I thought, but the rainbow is the same everywhere. So God set a sign that anybody in the world can see. And you know what? They don't have to be believers. Many people would have never heard of Yahweh, but they could see the rainbow. So you see the significance? A higher power. What's really amazing, for a nation to prosper, the nation does not have to be Christian. The nation does not even have to follow the God of the Bible. A nation has to follow a higher power. So, for a nation to prosper, according to the Noahic covenant, one, capital punishment. Two, acknowledge a higher power. And see, that explains something. That explains why some nations appear to be blessed by God, and we think, why in the world would He bless them? Some of it doesn't make any sense. I can tell you a whole list right now of nations that are clearly blessed. They're prospering, and I'm thinking, why? Well, you know why now? They follow the Noahic covenant. Here's what's important. God is not rewarding them. We have to understand that. God's not rewarding them. They're following the Noahic covenant. And if a nation acknowledges a higher power, even if it's not the God of the Bible, there's benefit. You know why? Because anybody who acknowledges a higher power will tend not to rely totally on himself. He will doubt his own self-effort. He will seek other counsel. So people, just by human nature, who acknowledge a higher power will tend to be successful. So if that nation acknowledges a higher power, even if it's incorrect, and if they exercise capital punishment, that will create a safe environment and the nation will prosper. It's as simple as that.
Nebuchadnezzar is a great example, because before he had people worshiping his idol. He was God.
Yes, he's one of many examples I'm just about to give right now. And it's okay. In human history, we find many examples of people who were not Christians, who were not believers, but they prospered. And the reason they prospered is that they followed the Noahic covenant. Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar. He worshipped Marduk. But Babylon, they practiced capital punishment, and by extension, they protected their own country. That's why, of all the places in the world for God to send his believing people into exile, the one place he sent them was Babylon. You know why? That was the safest place in the whole world. Because if you were within Nebuchadnezzar's bordery and you pledged your allegiance to him, you were perfectly safe. And you were safe from criminals and murderers, because they executed murderers really without much trial. I'm sure a lot of people who were innocent got punished. He went maybe too far that way, but he prospered. Nebuchadnezzar later obviously did come to faith. Persian Empire prospered. They acknowledged a higher power. It wasn't God, it was the gods. But they exercised capital punishment and protection. Alexander the Great, he worshipped the gods, higher power, but sure exercised capital punishment. Roman Empire, higher power. Was it God? No, it was the gods. They were wrong. But they acknowledged a higher power. Did they exercise capital punishment? Oh my goodness, yes. The cross, crucifixion, was contribution of the Romans. Fast forward, 20th century, Arab nations. We say, why would God reward them? I would say he's not necessarily rewarding them. Did they exercise capital punishment? Oh my gosh, yes. Did they acknowledge a higher power? Yeah. Not rewarding them. They're following the Noahic covenant. That's the deal. Remember, God gave the deal. If you do this, you'll be successful. Ones who follow it, they're successful. British Empire certainly exercised capital punishment and a higher power. And with the British Empire, now we start having nations that are acknowledging the correct higher power. With the British Empire, acknowledging God, Jesus. United States. What about the United States? Was the United States founded on Christian principles? And the answer is, it's a matter of semantics. Many of the founding fathers of America were certainly Christians. Maybe an astonishing number. Of the 50-something signers of the Declaration of Independence, some people have said that at least 40 or 45 were believers. Probably true. However, many of the key leaders, the players, were not Christians by any means whatsoever. Thomas Jefferson, definitely not. Benjamin Franklin, definitely not. Benjamin Franklin was a close friend of the evangelist Whitfield. And we kind of were reading something about Ben Franklin in his own words, where Benjamin Franklin talked about the great accomplishments of Whitfield, but he said he didn't believe it. So he said he's not a believer. So the issue is this. If we say, is America a Christian nation, I don't believe we look at the people. We look at the founding documents. And I believe we find something remarkable in the Declaration of Independence. I put the Declaration of Independence in. I believe, remarkably, that the Declaration of Independence was written by people who were consciously following the Noahic covenant. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth. Let me pause here. You see, they're acknowledging the sovereignty of nations. to assume among the powers of the earth, those of the other nations of the earth, the separate and equal station. We're seeking to become an equal sovereign nation just like the others. But look at the appeal to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. Laws of nature? I don't see, looking at nature, anything that would say, well, beautiful nature I see is justification for us being a new country. What's he talking about? I believe he's talking about the Noahic Covenant. The laws of nature. The nature of the new covenant. The regularity of nature. The God who establishes the regularity of nature. The God who established the predictability of nature as a benefit of the new covenant. I think that's what they're talking about. And that's why I think the Declaration of Independence was written in consciousness of the Noahic Covenant. The laws of nature and nature's God perfectly sums up the Noahic Covenant. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. That's very profound. He's saying, we recognize that the nations exist as they are. He's saying, therefore, if we are saying we want to separate ourselves from one and make a new, we owe an explanation. That's brilliant. What they're doing is they're honoring the existing borders and nations. Sounds like somebody knew Genesis 9, 10, and 11 to me. Oh, by the way, have you found any reference to the God of the Bible yet? I haven't. I found a vague reference to a higher power and to the Noahic Covenant. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Next paragraph. We therefore, the representatives of the United States of America in General Congress, assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, for the correctness is what they mean. The Supreme Judge of the world, when was the last time God spoke to the entire human race? Noahic Covenant. And for the support of this declaration with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence. You see, there's no gospel in the Declaration of Independence. There's not even a God of the Bible in the Declaration of Independence. But we certainly find an appeal for the provisions of the Noahic Covenant. Higher power. And of course, the early American colonies all had capital punishment. What's really intriguing is that the Declaration of Independence has references to a higher power, has references to the Noahic Covenant, but the Constitution, which is the legal basis of our government, has no reference of any kind to any higher power. I'm not saying this negatively. In fact, I'm saying this positively. For the Noahic Covenant, a country does not have to have the gospel. It has to follow the Noahic Covenant. That's why the sign is a rainbow, not the cross. Everybody can see the rainbow. So I guess we would say this, that America, instead of saying it's founded on Christian principles, we could say it's founded on a Judeo-Christian culture. Why? Because it's found in the Old Covenant. Noahic Covenant. I think we can say this, though. A nation that follows the Noahic Covenant is going to be prosperous just automatically by natural causes. However, I think God then steps in sovereignly and provides additional blessings for those countries who not only follow the Noahic Covenant, but who follow the real God of the Bible, who follow Jesus Christ. God will kick in sovereignly extra blessings. So the Noahic Covenant, including human government, capital punishment, is the way to be prosperous in an evil, fallen world. But I want to close by saying there's one big reason why God wants people to follow the Noahic Covenant. 1 Timothy 2:1, first of all then, I urge that entreaties and prayers, petitions and thanksgivings be made on behalf of all men, for kings and all who are in authority, so that we may lead a tranquil, quiet life, says, in all godliness and dignity. So what it says is, so that we may lead a tranquil, and that word means free from internal enemies, and that's created by capital punishment, and a quiet life, that means free from external enemies, that means from protecting the borders, in all well-being and maintaining a favorable culture. So you see, all these provisions of the Noahic Covenant, we say, well, doesn't God care about the gospel? Why would God say, you're successful even if you acknowledge a higher power that's not me? Doesn't God want people to know Him? The answer is yes. If governments follow the Noahic Covenant, that establishes a safe environment for the gospel to prosper. And ultimately, that's what God wants. This is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior, who desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. So we may say, well, God doesn't care if people acknowledge Him or a higher power. No, that's step one. If a nation acknowledges a higher power, protects the citizens internally and externally, that will be a climate where the gospel can flourish. An example is Nebuchadnezzar, who came to faith because his nation followed the Noahic Covenant. Next week, we'll go back chapter by chapter to the book of Leviticus. And next week, we begin this fascinating look at what animals were clean and what animals were unclean, and why no Cajun can read Exodus chapter 11. 90% of their diet would be eliminated.
Will you define the difference between killing and murder?
Murder is a sin, and it should be a crime of a nation. It means taking a human life without authorization. Killing is a generic term which can include lawfully taking a life according to the Bible, and that is, one, internally capital punishment, and two, it is lawful to kill your enemies. It is also lawful to kill your enemies in a preemptive strike if you know they're about to strike you first. So that's the difference. Murder is unlawfully taking a human life for no reason, an innocent person. Whereas killing is killing somebody under terms that are authorized by the Bible, which is someone who has done wrong and deserves capital punishment because they've murdered somebody, or your enemies. Those are legal killings. Father, we thank You. We thank You for giving us light and revelation. We thank You for the Noahic Covenant, what beautiful principles they are. And we thank You that You guided our nation in two ways. One, to have so many Christians there at the founding, to actually give a Judeo-Christian context and a culture to our lives. But You had those founders follow the Noahic Covenant, following Your provisions, capital punishment, honoring life, defending the lives of the citizens, and creating a culture for the gospel. And we thank You that You placed each one of us here within that culture, gave us access to the gospel. And we thank You that although the Noahic Covenant is a bilateral, requires human beings to do some things, we thank You that the covenant that saved us, the new covenant, the covenant of grace, is totally unilateral. You did it all. We thank You, and we thank You for Jesus, who also paid it all for us. And we thank You in His name this morning. Amen.